I'm Mark Gandy with CFO Bookshelf. If you listen regularly or follow the weekly newsletter, you'll know that I'm a fan of The Soul of Enterprise, hosted by Ron Baker and Ed Kless. And we even had Ron on the show, and it's one of our five most downloaded shows of our new podcast. Now, early in their show, several years ago, they mentioned the book, The Management Myth by Matthew Stewart. I immediately bought it, and I listened to it, and I couldn't put it down. And when I started the show about a year ago, Matthew was a marked man. I wanted to interview him. And so I'm thankful Matthew Stewart agreed to be on the show. We talk about management, strategic planning, Frederick Winslow Taylor, management consulting, the business gurus, and much more. That's coming up next here on CFO Bookshelf. So Matthew, before the book, your book, The Management Myth, and we're going to talk about why I love this book, but it started out as an article with The Atlantic. I'm going to cheat here in 2006, and then the book came out 3 years later, but the article did come first. Did you plan on writing a book, or was it just the article, and then now I'll do the book?
Yeah, so the backstory is that there was actually a version of the book before there was the article. Then there was the article, and then there was a new and improved version of the book. So I mean, when I finished working, which was just before 2000, I wanted to process the experience. I wanted to get it all down. I thought the world wanted to hear what I had to say. So I wrote down a draft of a book. I had trouble finishing it, couldn't get it out. I sent off an article to The Atlantic. They did not get back to me for about a year or 2 years. I had forgotten about it, in fact, when they got back to me.
A year? And, they're idiots. A year.
Well, they made the right call in the end. So, and of course, it ended up being one of their most read pieces for that, you know, that year or for several years. So it was quite a success. But it was just left there. And when that struck a chord, then I thought, well, I should really take the book more seriously. And I went back and redid it significantly.
I love the article, and we'll have a link to it in the show notes. I just want to pull out three quick points, which you also hit in the book, but you said that management theory is a subgenre of self-help. You remember that? You also stated that every framework from the five forces to the seven C's are just heuristics or mental models. And even though they can lead to solutions, they don't lead people to think on their own. Great point. And then finally, you're a philosopher. You said that philosophers are much better at knowing what they don't know. That's still true today, right?
That's right. The philosophers are actually more thoughtful about what they don't know. And I guess the one thing that you said that I'd like to really stress is that these heuristics or these theoretical frameworks do have some utility. I don't want to just throw them all out.
Right.
But the important thing is to recognize them for what they are, right? Okay. And not to pretend that they're a science when they're not.
Great point. We're going to get into the book, but I just want to ask you right off the bat, what is the management myth? What is it?
Of course, I want to encourage people to buy the book, so I want to keep a little bit of mystery. But the management myth is a kind of category that we make about management. We think management is a certain kind of thing. We think it is a technology. It's a way of doing things that you can learn in the same way that you bake a cake or something like that. And I think that's a fundamental mistake. That's the myth. And the reality is that it's actually a very human practice, and it's a form of sort of ethical life. So you cannot really separate management from the decisions we make about how to live a good life in a good community and to have a sensible world. So that's the myth I want to target, the idea that management is one thing and that it's a technology.
One thing I want to make very clear is, through our emails back and forth and preparing for this conversation, I know that you are a very humble person. And I need to say that for the next thing I want to say. This book is a classic. And I wish every MBA program in America across the globe that this was a required reading, because one of my frustrations, Matthew, as we were talking before we started, was I just feel like, you have all these management frameworks. There's that word again. And it almost seems like it's a religion. It's very cultic or cult-like. And it's like, why don't we go back and revisit the history? And so, again, the book is outstanding, which we'll do a little bit deeper dive here in a minute. But are you okay with me calling this book a classic?
Well, I'm totally okay. In fact, I wish you would just pass the message along with my publishers. That might make them feel a little bit better. But it does. You're also getting at something else that I really want to draw attention to, and that's that I think there's a lot of richness in thinking about management, and many of the things that have been written are about it are often written from a fairly narrow perspective, and we really could approach it from many different angles. I tried a sort of literary angle. I tried weaving together a bit of personal story and a bit of analysis. But I think other people could try, try to produce classics of their own. So that's the general gist, I think. And I hope people will take it as, something that will stimulate thought, not dictate it for them.
Your book is part memoir in a way. In fact, I was trying to study, what's it called when you write about yourself, but it's only one part of your life? And it's that time period where you got out of school, got your first job in consulting. So your background is unique. You don't have a business background.
Yeah, I think it's important for listeners to understand that I really do represent an outside perspective on these issues, because 2 weeks before I got a job as a management consultant, I didn't know what a management consultant was, and I would have been shocked and horrified to learn that I would become one in a couple of weeks. I was doing a DPhil or a doctoral degree in philosophy, in 19th century German philosophy, and I guess I've always been a kind of academic or intellectual at heart. I've always wanted to be a writer, and I finally did get to live the dream, but at the time, I needed the money. I needed a job. And it actually seemed to make sense to me in a certain strange way, that I could take these kind of thinking skills and writing skills and put them to use in this strange new occupation. This was the late 1980s, by the way, which is a slightly different world in all of that. But I fell backwards into it. And I guess the other important part of the story for anyone listening to understand is that I ended up staying a lot longer than I anticipated. So when I first approached it, it was, I think, the moral equivalent of taking a job as a waiter for me. I mean, I thought I'll have a job and then I'll figure things out. And I, through a complicated series of steps, I ended up getting involved in setting up a new firm. That meant that all the money I made, I had to put into the firm. And then for various, very complicated and not all the other pleasant reasons, I had a lot of difficulty getting the money out of the firm. And the net of it was that I spent 10 years in the business, not all of it on the job, but some of it where I did take some breaks. But so it's a very unusual story. But I hope that makes it interesting for people, because I really was looking at it from the outside. And I'm hopefully opening a perspective on it.
If I'm not mistaken, you interviewed, or you didn't interview, you applied for about 10 or so different firms. And then the last one said, we're looking for someone different. And you got that one.
Yeah. The actual word they used was experimental hires.
Experimental.
I really felt like a laboratory animal at that point,
And I thought,
but it was fair, because I was in the market for an experimental job.
And I thought it was hilarious. You when you got hired, I don't know if it was right away, but you started reading the Financial Times and some other business publications to help you start learning the lingo, the acumen. That was hilarious.
Yeah, we all have to try to remember these pre-internet days, right?
Because, yep.
It was the 1980s, and I was studying in England. And I was pretty disconnected from the world. And so I didn't know what any of this stuff was. And so I literally went to the college library and got the Financial Times, and I found these books on corporate finance. I mean, it was funny and slightly sad at the same time. But and then as I explain in the book, all that preparation didn't amount to anything, didn't help at all. My 2 weeks of cramming didn't have anything to do with the interview, or the interview had nothing to do with that.
Where as you started writing this, and this is after you got out of consulting, what made you step back and want to look at the history of consulting, you go all the way back to Frederick Winslow Taylor, who is really, I guess, the god, quote unquote, of efficiency, which, by the way, we learned he was a little bit of a, well, maybe it wasn't everything he thought he was. So selling some snake oil, maybe. But where did the idea come from to go back to him?
Yeah, no, he's a funny guy, and we should definitely get to him. But to your question about the what drew me into the subject, setting aside the personal side, there are these major changes that have taken place in our economy over the past 40 years. And some of them are very obvious, but sometimes I think they're so obvious that we overlook them. And the ones that I was particularly interested to explain were, first, the tremendous growth in this kind of professional managerial sector. So I mean, explosive growth in the business schools, explosive growth in management consulting. I don't have the numbers off the top of my head. They're in my book, but they are order of magnitude changes in what was going on. I think that was something that I thought needed to be explained. And then the other broader socioeconomic issue is rising inequality. I mean, we had the CEOs sort of back when in my high school, an earlier period would have been, you know, at 20 or 30 times the average wage. And I guess there was a sense that they were higher up on the tree than everybody else. But in the subsequent decades, as we all know, they left the tree and sort of climbed up a mountain. So I thought those issues had to be explained. But those are the larger scale issues. And then you brought up Taylor. I got to say that, you know, as an academic monk and historian of philosophy, I do like to understand origins. I think that we can get a lot by saying, you know, how this sausage was made in the past.
Agree.
And even I, with my, you know, fairly distanced and somewhat cynical, was pretty astounded by what I discovered with Frederick Winslow Taylor. Because, you know, he's the original founder of the idea of scientific management. His book, The Principles of Scientific Management, right. 1911, got that idea out there. And there was a good side to that. It said that, you know, management is something that can be analyzed and where people can be held accountable and you can measure things and so on. But he backed up that idea with all of this so-called research that he was doing, right? And he told the story about the research that he was doing. And while I can't go into too many of the details now, let's just say that when you look at the individual stories that he tells about how he made a certain operation more efficient, it falls apart like a bad, you know, a bad cake or something. It's all just crumbs and there's nothing left. So that was, I thought, quite interesting and revealing that, the science was never really there in scientific management.
We won't list all of the gurus, but I think the next one they came up was it Mayo, I believe. And then we just kept going further and further in time until we get to Tom Peters. And what I learned just in going through those names, every one of those gurus, they're flawed, aren't they? All of them.
Yeah.
but why do we buy in? Well, you're the philosopher. Why do we buy in? I like to think I'm cynical, by the way, very skeptical of, you know, I want to, you know, prove it, but yet we still give in. Why is that?
Well, you know, Mark, you mentioned at the beginning that you saw that, or that people are looking for religion in some sense, and yes, they're looking for an answer. And I think that gets at the core of the issue. This is driven by demand. It's driven by what people want to hear, and what people want to hear is the answer. They want to hear the story that packages it all up and gives you the three values that you're going to aim for. And so that's what the management gurus then deliver. So, I would look first and foremost at the audience and ask why is it that we have this craving for that kind of religious story? I like to see it as a mixed thing. I mean, look, it makes sense. Of course, people want answers. So, of course, it makes sense for someone to deliver. But, you know, let's just be honest. A lot of these guys are basically hucksters, and the the trajectory, the history, as you point out, it's not that there's just one bad apple. There's not just Frederick Winslow Taylor. It's sort of one after the other is really profoundly flawed. I mean, not to go too far into the Elton Mayo stuff, but here's the guy who is at the foundation of the human relations school of management thought. And he's also in some ways a key founder of modern sociology, or at least the sociology that deals with organizations. So he's a big figure, and he's associated with these so-called Hawthorne experiments, which is, people may remember this from some, freshman class in college, and it has to do with the importance of paying attention to your workers and so on. Mm-hmm. So the general principle that he's talking about is good. It makes sense. But then when you examine it, it turns out that there was no Hawthorne experiment. There was no real research, and the Mayo summarized it inaccurately and, in fact, fraudulently. So, and that's just Mayo. And then you can keep going on. There's, Tom Peters, and then Peter Drucker is sort of identified as this as the one respectable guru. And yet, honestly, his stuff doesn't really, it can't be counted as very serious research, I think. And I think that says something about what's going on there. It says something about the nature of the discipline.
This may be an unfair question, but I want to give it a try. So Tom Peters, his book came out, In Search of Excellence, his first one in 1982, I believe. So if he happened to be in Boston and you two happen to meet each other and you go to a coffee shop, can I ask you, and you can say, Mark, it's none of your business, or Mark, I would say no, but what would you talk about over coffee? I would love to be a fly. I'd love to be a fly on the wall in that coffee meeting.
Yeah, no, I'd be happy to sit down with Tom, my new friend, as you're making him. And my sense is it'd probably be a lot of fun, because one thing I find kind of endearing about Tom Peters is that he kind of is upfront about what he's doing to some degree. I mean, there's some kind of revealing and funny quotes where he says things like, okay, yeah, I know that what we've been talking about is all a bunch of motherhoods and platitudes. And I think at some point he says, okay, a lot of what I've said is a bunch of baloney. So he seems to recognize what he's doing. I'll tell you where I would challenge him, though, because I do like to provoke, and especially if we're at that cafe for more than an hour or so, I might get to this point. I might say, look, Tom, this is all great. You're teaching these platitudes and motherhoods, but you are not paying attention to the role that your cheerleading plays in hiding from people some of the more profound issues of what's going on in the workplace, right? I mean, you can be a cheerleader for, committing yourself to the work and being super creative, but unless you recognize that in a lot of cases, it's just a question of power and who has power and who doesn't have power. Or in a lot of cases, it's really about trust, about who, about whether managers and workers or teams trust one another or not. Unless you're willing to recognize that there are these serious political issues, then you might just be kind of covering up for people. You might be just serving as part of the problem. I think I might push it that way, but I might not. I mean, he seems to me like a nice guy.
I agree, and I do follow him on Twitter. I'm not going to say he's mellowed, but this is opinion. I'm going to throw it out there. I think if he were to read the book, if he hasn't already, and I hope he has, I bet he would say, Matthew, you nailed it.
No, I mean, I hope you pass the message along. I have to say, I haven't followed him. I'm glad to hear that he's out there.
The NBA love affair. Now, I know it's been a while since you've been consulting. I'm sure you still have opinions about the overall, the value of the NBA today. And by the way, you did have some good reasons for having, what good can come out of an MBA, especially at a top school. But why is there that love affair still, even today? And I think your numbers in the book, I think you stated in the book, 18,000 as of 1968. And then my last number that I looked up, it's around 200,000 graduating annually with an MBA. I think in the book 10 years ago, you were in that, you stayed about 140. So the numbers do keep going up. But why the love affair?
So our society in general has really moved towards this credentialing model. And so there's no question that a big part of it is this, you know, drive for credentials, and it's just one way to sort people out. I guess the other thing that's driving it is the higher cost of education. So when people have to spend so much for an education, they really start to demand that it be practical. But of course, what they really mean by practical is not necessarily that it teach you something that will be practical, but that it can just get you a job, which isn't quite the same thing. And I think that's what's really driving it. I wish there's no simple answer to it, because sure, some kind of business focused education can be very useful for some people. I don't doubt that we could restructure it. And some schools are doing this. I have spoken with some, you know, very professors at different business schools, and they are trying different things. But one approach that I like that some of them are taking is saying, okay, we're preparing people for business. That doesn't necessarily mean that we're just studying business in some narrow sense. Right. So they start to bring in other courses. They look at broader social and economic issues. There was a nice course at Columbia that I participated in that was looking at social divides in America, kind of course you'd see typically in a history faculty or perhaps a sociology faculty. Included in the business school. So that's one approach I think to take. Another approach is that I really wish employers would be a little more open-minded. I mean, why do they need to insist on that credential? When I looked at the data, and this is now about 10 years old, when I looked at it, and especially in the field of consulting, the evidence that the MBA as a degree improves performance relative to some other form of education is incredibly thin. I mean, it's, you know, the people with those PhDs in philosophy, man, I tell you, they just do really well. They do at least as well as the MBAs. So, or better. So I think opening the minds of employers is another, you know, key part of it. And then I guess a final thing, I'm getting a little long winded here. I apologize. Final thing is, I think the idea of continuing education, right? I do think that we need to, as a society, move away from the, you know, massive injection of education when you're 20 or 23 years old or whatever, and more towards a thing where it's something you come back to and pick up in pieces.
By the way, please do not apologize. Keep talking if you want to. There's one part of the book I absolutely love. And now that you know, I've come out of the closet to state that I've read this multiple times, you've gotten more than one standing ovation. It's the concept or the topic of strategic planning. Earlier this year, I was on a panel discussion talking about strategic planning. And when it got to my turn, the question was asked, Mark, what is strategic planning? My answer was, well, guys, it's a $2 billion industry. And I did get a little bit of a laugh, but you talk about strategic planning, and I appreciate your sarcasm. I appreciate the way you approached it, and I just want to say nothing's changed, Matthew. It's almost like, okay, which manual are you going to? First of all, what guru are you going to follow, and what manual? But they're all about the same. Well, what would you say about strategic planning today? If you were updating the book again, or were going to, would you make any changes to it?
Yeah, well, I got to say that is both gratifying and slightly frustrating that the world has not changed as much as I thought it would. In fact, I think I should just tell my publisher to do a reprint and say it was published in 2020 and see what happens.
I agree.
I'm sure there would be updates, but in the long historical perspective, one thing that I found quite striking as I looked into the history was that For many, many years, decades after management was invented, there was no strategy or strategic planning. So all the way from the early 20th century until about, I guess it's some, the first signs of change were in the 60s, but not until, I would say, the 1980s with Michael Porter, you actually have strategy, right?
Right.
I think strategic planning, I suppose, started a little bit before that. But and not only that, but the business schools consciously said, first of all, they called it policy. And secondly, they said, well, this isn't really something for us to study. I mean, this is just something you kind of do. And you don't need to kind of study it formally. And honestly, that position is just as coherent as the modern one, which says, oh yes, it's this discipline. And it's kind of like being a Greek general, except that instead of, you know, having these, hoplite soldiers, you've got, cars and computer chips or something. And it's, it's kind of sad. It also makes for pretty bad reading. I mean, most of the stuff I've read in strategic planning, that's the hardest stuff to get through, I think.
And I'm just thinking of some of the greatest startups in the world. I mean, I just read the story of Netflix by one of the co-founders, and they didn't do strategic planning. Salesforce, when it started, I just interviewed the CFO who took them public a week ago. They didn't do strategic planning back then. So it's like, we could learn a lot about some of these startups who are having to just figure things out by just listening to their customers. But I'm not going to give away anything in the book. No spoilers here. The first book, or one of the first books I think Drucker wrote, Managing for Results, it was supposed to have another, you're nodding, you're supposed to have another title. That was an aha moment. And we'll leave the suspense there. And you'll get to figure something out. That's good research on your part. A couple last things on the book, real quickly. Near the end, you stated, and I did a little reading myself, and I agree with you. You said that CEOs are not necessarily reading the gurus, and I agree with you. I like to read people's book lists, so there'll be CEOs that are interviewed and they'll say, what are you reading? And I'm amazed at some of the things that they're it's not business books. So do you want to elaborate a little bit just as you were writing this? I know it's been more than 10 years ago, but it's true. They don't always read the gurus, correct?
Yeah, that's right. And as a general rule, with plenty of exceptions, I tended to find that if I asked somebody what they were reading and I learned that they were reading the gurus, that was a warning sign. Whereas if they told me they were reading something else, that usually could be a much more positive sign. So, I'm going to date me, but when I was in consulting, I do remember there were people reading, for example, about Hitler and Stalin. There was a good book that came out by James Bullock at that time. There was also the very successful book on the making of the atomic bomb. Other things like that. I mean, and then, you know, some people, of course, reading The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, things like that. Mm-hmm. You know, my experience has been that when you find someone who's reading that kind of thing, that's generally a much more positive sign for their, their managerial skills and relevance than reading some gurus.
This may be an unfair question as we start wrapping up here, Matthew. I know it's been a while since you've been in the consulting industry, but looking at the type of consultants you work with in your own firm, are those types of consultants needed today? I mean, really needed.
Yeah. Well, as you know, Mark, there are, as many different kinds of consultants as there are.
Right.
Varieties of cheese at the grocery store or whatever. So there's, it would be unfair to lump them all in one bucket. So you're just talking about a very narrow sliver of the kind that I represented, which was sort of the so-called strategy boutique things. And honestly, I wish that we could move towards a world where there's a much smaller number of them where they were, more seriously professional. I think that some of the bigger ones now really don't deserve to exist. I mean, McKinsey seems to be going from one catastrophe to another.
Right.
And the case that they have left behind any sort of professional or ethical responsibility seems, you know, sadly very strong. I think the world could do with a lot less of that. Which is not to say that there isn't room for something. I mean, I do think that you know, an outsider bringing perspective to a business can be very helpful. I think that there's absolutely room for people who are familiar with a particular sector who can bring expertise to bear. So I don't, you know, there's plenty of room for consultants, but there is a kind of general consultant, a sort of, you know, hired gun that's there to kind of paper over, you know, often power plays. And I think that, you know, the world would probably be better off with a bit less than that.
For people like me and other people who are self-aware, and we do want to read and continually learn, and I didn't finish part of my sentence, who want to read widely, not narrowly, what can marketers, what can operating people, supply chain people, CEOs, we mentioned just a few minutes ago, of course, CFOs like me, what would be some suggestions you would have of continuous learning reading program? And again, I have a feeling you're going to say what interests you, but again, with the philosophy background, you obviously read widely. Literature, I'm assuming too. And what are some suggestions?
Well, I think that many people have been very lucky or successful in joining up with their local groups. I mean, it may just be a book club or it may be something more formal, but I think that it's a good idea to try to do something with other people so that you can talk about it, you know? And in terms of, I mean, you're right. I am going to just fall back on what interests you because the world is so wide. And I think reading is just one part of the sort of experiences people should be looking for. I mean, I would add, some travel and, other kinds of experiences too, as a way of mixing things up. Because I do think we should take all a holistic understanding of what we're doing as we're going through the working world and not narrow it down unnecessarily.
As we're recording this, we're on a Zoom recording, and I apologize if I'm turning away from you. I accidentally deleted my Amazon page. I had your books. I actually bought another one of your books this morning, and I'm going to try to get through it later in the year. It's about the time period of the American Revolution, and I'm anxious to get some insights. What is that title that I bought? It's already escaped me, but I promise.
Yeah, that one's Nature's God: The Heretical Origins of the American Republic, and so that's it's a fairly long book. I have to caution you.
It's all right.
It's about the philosophical origins of the American Revolution. I mean, if you want me to recommend the book, you might enjoy a little more The Courtier and the Heretic. It's about Leibniz and Spinoza, and it's a little more to the point, and in a way, it's the prequel to the Nature's God.
Oh, it is. And by the way, I was reading some of your reviews. They're great. I don't think I've read anyone that says this is a terrible book. So that I did look at that one. I didn't buy it yet, and I was going to ask you about it. And that's going to be one last question I had for you about philosophy. One of the books I have is called The Worldly Philosophers. And it's just many bios, like each chapter is about 20, 30 pages of a famous philosopher. Is, I don't know if you've read it. Maybe it may be on your bookshelf somewhere.
No, it doesn't ring a bell. Who's the author of that?
You know, if you just look up The Worldly Philosophers on Amazon, again, it's a little dry, but I was just going to ask you, just from a philosophy standpoint, are there any titles that you recommend?
Right. No, and there are many, many good books. I mean, I still remember some of the sort of classic histories. So there was this The Story of Philosophy by Will Durant. It was a big hit, I think,
yes,
in the 1950s or still, 60s.
It still is.
It still is. Yes, it's a great book. I mean, he tells the story very well, and it's accurate to the extent that it can be within a small number of pages. So I like that. I like Bertrand Russell, but that's more of a personal taste. He's kind of this cantankerous witty guy. I'm not sure he would be appropriate for everybody. It's a little long.
Last question. In light of the management myth, and again, thank you for writing that book, what is a good manager?
So the management is really about getting people to work together. Tom Peters is going to agree with me on this.
Yes, he will.
It's about getting people to work together. And that just means getting them to have confidence in one another and to have to build a strong foundation for trust. So I think, you know, a good manager is, you know, ultimately someone who is able to, in a sense, be a good follower.
I don't think I'm going to get any pushback from you. Anyone in business should read this book. Even this morning in one of my meetings with the CEO, his daughter is going to school, wants to work for, I think she did an internship with Accenture. And I said, she needs to read The Management Myth. Now, she may not get it until maybe 10 years later. I said, make sure she reads the book, but everyone should read this book. And I hope you are agreeing with me.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate the kind words.
Hi, everyone. This is Brian Jones of The Table Group and the author of Ordinary Greatness, available wherever fine books are sold. Thank you for listening to CFO Bookshelf. I do not let 7 days go by without listening to this podcast.
You are listening to CFO Bookshelf, lifelong learning for financial leaders. And now, back to our host, Mark Gandy.
Once again, the book is The Management Myth, Debunking Modern Business Philosophy by Matthew Stewart. Great book, great listen to if you have an Audible account. I give it 5 stars out of 5. And again, Matthew, thank you for your time. Keep learning, keep growing, keep making a difference. I'm Mark Gandy with CFO Bookshelf.